Just the beginning of as we look at the season of Easter coming up. Next week is Palm Sunday, and then Easter the following week on the 4th of April. And we're excited and hope that you will come and join us, and those of you online will join us here as well. Thank you very much. Well, today we're going to talk about a subject that I would like to avoid. Okay? Seriously, it's one of the worst passages in the entire Bible. I'm telling you the truth, because I've talked to a lot of friends, a lot of pastors, I've read a lot of books about this, and a lot of commentaries, and the amazing thing is when people come to the passage we're about to come with, they come already convinced at what it says before they read what it says. Most of us, when we read the Bible, this is the way we should read the Bible. We get in our passage and we're reading the Bible and we're saying, God, what is it you want me to learn? How do you want to teach me on this and all? That's a good way to learn about the Bible, right? A good way to learn about Jesus, good way to learn about the doctrines and everything, but not this passage. Everybody comes to this passage with an opinion beforehand. And you will too. You already have it. You don't know what passage I'm going to do yet. You don't know what's in the passage. But it has to do with women and their role in the church. I'll just lay it out. That's what it says. It's about women in the church. And everybody has an opinion. Now, if you're a new person to church and you've never walked into a church, you may not have an opinion about this. But everyone sitting around you does have an opinion. They have an opinion this way, an opinion that way, an opinion that way, an opinion this way. And so by the end of today, all of you are going to be mad at me. Just want you to know, every single one of you will at one point or another go, yeah, I agree with that. And the next time you're going, no, I don't agree with that. But we're going to look at the Word. I'm going to let the Bible speak to us, hopefully today, and kind of see what it has to say. But before we do, I've got to give some thoughts to this. First of all, we've got to talk about truth. Truth. Truth has changed over time. The concept of absolute truth. Do you believe in absolute truth? Absolute truth is defined as this. It simply means that it's the same truth back then as it is now. It's true across the street. It's true over here. It's true in Africa. It's true in Asia. It's just always true. It's one of those truths that's always true. So that's what absolute truth is. Then the other type of truth is relative truth. Now, we hear that word a lot, and I'm not using it the way it's used today, which is, I have my truth, you have your truth, they have their truth, and everybody has their own truth. That's relative truth too. But the real meaning behind relative truth means that it is only true sometimes and not true other times. That means it's relative. It could be true here, but it's not true there. And what confuses people is that the Bible speaks about absolute truth, and the Bible also has, I'm glad you didn't bring tomatoes, relative truth in it. Yes, it has relative truth in it. Let me explain. Absolute truth. Jesus said, love your neighbor as yourself. I believe that was true when he said it, because it comes also out of the law of Moses, it comes out of the nature of God, and it's true today. You need to love your neighbor as yourself. It was said 2,000 years ago, but it is an absolute truth every place, every time, everywhere. Jesus also said in the story of Easter, if you'll recall, in the Palm Sunday part of the story, he told his disciples, several of them, to go into the city to find a colt, a little donkey, that has never been ridden on, and tell the owner of the colt, we are taking it for the master. Remember that story? That is relative truth. That was good for that day. That is not good for today. If you go down to Meisner Park and you pick out the car you like and you go to the owner and go, give me the key because God told me that it is now my car, you are not basing it on anything but your own self-destruction, because it is relative truth. When Jesus told when the disciples told Jesus, we got to pay our taxes, and Jesus said, grab that fish and open its mouth and there's a coin in it and pull that coin out and pay your taxes, that's relative truth. That was truth for then. At that point in time, it is not truth for today. Our taxes are due in a month, or a couple of weeks, and I guess they've extended it for a couple more weeks. But if you go looking and go fishing and looking for coins in a, you go, well, it's in the Bible. It should be true then. It should be true now. No, it is not. Because there's absolute truth and there's truth that's not. And you go, okay, how does that apply here? So even on our property, we have absolute truth and relative truth. Absolute truth is we have a high value for people in this church. That comes out of the image of God, the Imago Dei, a very high view of children, a high view of people, a high view of humans. There is a road that goes right between our property, Fourth Avenue, right? That's relative truth. The city has said you can only go 30 miles an hour on that road. It used to be 35 miles an hour. Well, they've changed it. Why? Because it's relative. But if you go out there at 8 o'clock in the morning on a school day and you go 30 miles an hour, you're breaking the law. You're breaking the truth because it's a school zone and you have to go 20 miles an hour. And you go, of course, because truth is relative depending on the time of day, whether kids are in school, whether it's spring break, whether it's winter break, whether they're there, whether they're not there, because truth is relative at times. And we as Christians don't like to hear that truth is relative. It's only absolute. But realize it is true that if you go 40 miles an hour on 4th Avenue, you will get a ticket. I've watched it. I live on 4th Avenue. I see the tickets that are given. So I'm just telling you ahead of time that obey the traffic laws. But if you go out to Glades Road, it's 45 miles an hour. You go, why? Because it's relative to the circumstances of the moment. Do you see that? So there's absolute truth, and there is relative truth, and relative truth is real truth. It is good truth, but it's not true all the time, every time. George Washington never went 40, 50 miles an hour ever in his life on the little horse he had. Now, there's also biblical authority versus biblical interpretation. There are parts of the Bible that are so authoritative that you just got to believe it or not believe it, but it's true no matter what. It is authority. And there are things in the Bible that have authority. What are those? That God created the world, that there is a God, that there's a Trinity. There's God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit, and God broke the relationship with God, and then God wanted to reestablish that relationship, and so he sent his son, Jesus Christ. That's the Christmas story. He lived a perfect life. Then the Easter story is that he was crucified, he died, he was buried, he rose again, and because he lives, we too shall live. That's biblical authority. That's absolute. You can't change that. Either you believe it or you don't believe it, but believing it or don't believing it or not believing it doesn't make it true or false. It's not my truth, it's God's truth, and if it's God's truth, it's true forever. That's biblical authority. But now there's biblical interpretation within the context. So for instance, this morning we dedicated four families and their six or eight children there, right? Now you go to some churches and they christen children. You go to other churches and they baptize children. I don't believe in christening. I don't believe in baptism of infants. But I tell you what, it's an interpretation. We're going to have a baptism at the beach in a few weeks, I think in April. We baptize by immersing people into the water. That's a biblical interpretation. This church baptizes into the water all the way. Some of my good close friends sprinkle people. Other good close friends put a little cross with some oil right here, and that's their baptism. Some pour water on people, and that's their baptism. It's not the way I do it, but can I tell you this? If someone put a gun to my head and said, you can only sprinkle, I will sprinkle, because it's an interpretation. But if someone puts a gun to my head and says, deny Christ, I would say, shoot. See the difference? I'm not dying over whether I should have put water on these children or not put water on these children. That's interpretation. I am dying over the biblical authority of who God is and what he has done in our life. There is a huge difference. The problem is we mix them up. And we turn interpretation into authority and authority into interpretation. And it gets mixed up in the whole thing. So I use this example, and you've seen me do it, of the hand. What is it that you hold in your hand, biblically now I'm speaking, it's a metaphor, that you are not going to let go? And what is it that you hold in your hand that I still hold it in my hand, but if it gets let go, it gets let go? And you've got to decide what those core things, because here's the thing. You older people with gray hair like me, we're going to be long gone, but these young children are going to have to deal with what they hold tight in your hand more and more, because what we hold tight in our hand biblically is going against the grain of our society. Years ago, it kind of went a little parallel. Some places you live were more parallel than others, but right now it is divergent. And so our children, and many of you who are middle-aged and lower, and even us who are older, are going to experience the reality that we are going to be challenged with that which we hold in our hands. So you got to make sure you know what you hold in your hand tight, because it's your arms are going to be shaken, and this world's going to shake them. And we've got to teach our people, teach our children, teach ourselves what is biblical authority and what is interpretation. Because I'm going to tell you what, again, if someone came and said, you know, you got to sing in unison instead of harmony, or we're going to close the church down, I'll sing in unison. That's an interpretation. There are some churches that only allow singing in unison. We sing in harmony. There are some churches that have candles and are very contemplative in their worship. We're very loud and celebratory in our worship. Okay, which is right? Either. It doesn't matter. It's an interpretation. It's a part of, if you want to worship quietly, let's worship quietly. If you want to worship loud, let's worship loud. Do you see the difference? But if you want to take Christ out of our worship, that doesn't work. See, interpretation versus authority. And it's so important. So now, well, another word you could use is church doctrine versus church traditions. There are doctrines of the church that we have to hold tightly, and there are traditions of our church that we just got to let go from time to time. Let me give you an example. A couple of months ago, just before COVID, we had this big event. There was an event up at a church north of here, and a bunch of us at the staff went to it. It's great. Hundreds of people there. It was early in the morning, and they were worshiping. And the lady leading gets up there and goes, "We just want to return back to the first century, like the early church, and worship like them." I thought, wow, this is pretty cool. As I turned around, I saw 13 people working the lights and the cameras and the booms and the sound and the fog. And I saw all the electronics and she goes, "We just want to return back to the first century." I'm going, "Ma'am, you can't return back to the first century. We do not live in the first century. We live in the 21st century, and we worship God in the 21st century, not in the first century. It is impossible to worship like they worshiped then." And not that they were right and we are wrong. It is just different. There's interpretations to it, and we need to understand that. The reality of where you're sitting today, you're sitting in an air-conditioned building. This building is bigger than except four buildings in all the world in the first century. You're in a building bigger than every building in the first century minus four. Well, and this is one of the small buildings. You see, you cannot return to the first century. We have to understand how to do it today. And so that's the interpretation of it. Now, we go to the city in which this was done. So let's turn to 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 8 to 15. 1 Timothy 2, 8 to 15. And recall, as I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, and thank you, Francois, for teaching for us last week. Didn't he do a great job? Thank you, Francois. While our family had an opportunity to take a few days away, it was great. We had almost our entire family together, my mom and dad, some of the grandchildren, great-grandchildren together. It was really a great time. Thank you for letting us have a few days off. I'll come to what he said last week in a few moments. But what we talked about just before that was that this book is written from Paul to Timothy to the church at Ephesus. He's writing to Timothy, who's the head of the church at Ephesus. This is important. You go, well, who cares whether it's Galatia or Corinth or Rome or Jerusalem. Who really cares? It's very important because the context of 1 Timothy is about the Ephesians. Ephesus was one of the four top leading cities in the Roman Empire at that time. It was a trading city. They had everything in that city. In fact, their ruins that they found in the late 1800s, the city had been destroyed or been covered up years before, but from silt in the harbor. They found the city in the late 1800s, and they've excavated it. And if you go there, they're my favorite ruins in the entire world. They are unbelievable. They have libraries and amphitheaters and circuses and huge avenues. This was a developed city, and it had a temple, the temple of Diana. Diana, a Greek god, was the goddess of fertility, sexuality, the whole human sexual experience. The Roman version is Artemis, and so they were the goddesses that ran, and I use that in quotes, the city. This very Gentile city had a small Jewish remnant, but a very Gentile city. And Paul is talking to Timothy, and Timothy is in this very worldly city. How do we know this? Because in the verse preceding, verse 8, verse 7 says this, "For this I was appointed," Paul's talking to Timothy, "a preacher and an apostle." And he goes this, he goes, "I'm telling you the truth, I'm not lying." Now, why would Paul, an apostle, have to tell one of his proteges, "I'm telling you the truth, I'm not lying"? It'd be like, you know, my dad saying, "Bill, I'm not lying to you," or me telling my dad, "Of course you're not lying, you're telling the truth, I trust you." So why is Paul saying this to Timothy, who he led to the Lord and all this other stuff? Because he's saying, "You're not going to believe what I'm about to tell you, but I just want to tell you, I'm telling you the truth, it's not a lie. I am a teacher of the Gentiles. This book is a book to the Gentiles." Most of us in this room are Gentiles. But the Gentiles in Ephesus were people who did not grow up in the religious understanding of the Bible, or as it was called back then, the Torah and all the other, the law of Moses. They had none of that understanding. They're coming to the Lord, and they're coming into church, and they've never been into what we would call a real situation of godliness. They had a form of it in the temple of Diana, but that form was temple prostitution, was all the orgies and all of that. They come into the church having worship, and they're used to worshiping a certain way, and they're coming into church now going, "Okay, we're ready." And Paul's saying, "Timothy, you got to tell them it's not the way you used to do it, men and women. Do you see it now?" These people were coming to the Lord out of a whole different worldview, social system called the Roman Empire in Ephesus. You see, much of the New Testament was written to Jews that were in the Roman cities. Well, this is written to all the believers that have come to Christ in Ephesus. Now let's read the passage, verse 8 to 15. "I desire then that in every place the men should pray, lifting holy hands without anger or quarreling. Likewise also that women should adorn themselves in respectable apparel with modesty and self-control, not braided with hair, not braiding their hair, and nor gold or pearls or costly attire, but with what is proper for women who profess godliness, which is good works. Let a woman learn quietly with all submissiveness. I do not permit a woman to teach or to exercise authority over a man. Rather, she is to remain quiet. For Adam was formed first, then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived and became a transgressor. Yet she will be saved through childbearing if they continue in faith and love and holiness and self-control." And now you know why I don't want to teach this. But can I tell you, it has been a great week, because I feel I really begin to understand this passage. We think this passage is about the role of women in leadership in the church, and it is not. This passage is about godly living and how we worship the Lord. Can we look at this? So last week, Francois taught us in the preceding seven verses of chapter 2, which we won't go to, the importance of prayer. In fact, there were four parts of prayer that he talked about: supplications, intercessions, thanksgiving, and prayer itself. And he talked about that and got into some detail in that, which is perfect. Those are not the only ways to prayer. There's other prayer types you can do, but those were four that were mentioned. And then he comes, that's Paul, not Francois, Paul says, I desire that in every place, and now he's starting and continuing the conversation of how to worship and meet with the Lord. And he says, men, you should pray. Now he just told him how to pray, told Timothy how to teach the people to pray. And now he's saying, Timothy, you teach the men how to pray. And he says this, lifting holy hands without anger or quarreling. Okay, men, this is what you're supposed to do. This is men in Ephesus. You are supposed to pray lifting holy hands, not angry and not quarreling. Why do you have to lift your hands? Now, can I just pause for a minute? Let's go over here for a minute. How do we pray? We bow our heads and close our eyes, right? I say that at the end of the week. Let's bow our heads and close our eyes. That never happened until the 1820s. In the second Great Awakening of Charles Finney, who started having invitations in his rallies, and he wanted people to come forward, and people weren't coming forward because they were embarrassed at how people watched other people come forward. And even Billy Graham took that over in many of the Billy Graham campaigns. And Luis Palau did that as well in some of his campaigns, who just passed away 2 weeks ago. And they would say, bow your heads and close your eyes. Well, that's just one way to pray. That's the way we choose to pray. That's an interpretive side of praying. But all through the Bible, sometimes you're on your face prostrate. Sometimes you're on your knees. Sometimes your hands are lifted. In this case, he says, lift your hands. Why? Because the men of Ephesus were violent men. It was a violent culture. The Roman men had the ability to hurt people physically on whomever they wanted to. And the higher the socioeconomic status, they could hurt anybody, even if they weren't related, and do that. They could hurt. So, and how did they hurt? They did it with their hands. They probably had a knife or some other way. And what did he say? Let's get your hands where they need to be when you pray. They need to be in a humble place of lifting, because God is in charge, man, and you are not. And when you pray, get those hands up, because when you're in anger, what are you doing? You have your hands like this. Or worse, you have pulled something like this. Right? Nope. Get those hands up here when you pray, because anger is not a part of God's economy. And he says, quarreling. What do you do when you quarrel? You point that finger at people. I'm mad at you. I'm mad at you. I'm mad at God. I'm mad at this person. I'm mad at her. I'm mad at him. Nope. Get those hands back in and humbly before God when you pray. This passage is about prayer, that we men who have anger issues, you might have some pride issues, you might have some quarreling spirit in you. When you pray to God, get those hands wide open and facing him and going, God, there's nothing I bring to you except my gift of prayer to you. And Francois, if you weren't here last week, gave a great example of the quietness of prayer, the silence of prayer, how God speaks to you. You remember what he said? And he's saying, do it like this. Then he goes, likewise. Okay, so this passage continues when he starts to talk about women. He doesn't go, okay, men, you pray with your arms up. Don't quarrel. Don't anger. Now we're going to talk about women leaders in the church. It's not what it's about. It's about prayer, worship, and understanding your relationship to God. I'm seeing the daggers. You got to put the daggers down. I'm seeing those eyes. Wow, that's great. I know where he's going. I know where he's going. Likewise, also, women should adorn themselves in respectable apparel with modesty and self-control. Women, if you want to worship God, you've got to do it in modesty and with self-control. It's kind of the premise here, the argument here, the subject of the matter. Not with braided hair, gold, pearls, or costly attire. Okay. Women, I'll talk to you for just a moment. Men, you're off the hook just for a minute because I'm going to come back and hit you later. Women, every woman, don't do it, just pretend, who has hair braided or pulled back, who has any gold on them, any pearl on them, or has costly attire on them, leave. Don't leave. But can I tell you, every woman in this room would leave. Why? Because everything you have is costly attire. You don't realize, you go, oh, I only bought this at Marshall's, which would still cost about 30 days' wage for 90% of the world. That's costly attire. Maybe not costly attire compared to the person next to you who bought their stuff at Target, or the person next who bought to Macy's, and the person next to them who bought at Saks, and the person next to them who bought at Nordstrom, and the person next to them bought at Neiman Marcus. And we just keep going up the hill, and we go, well, I'm not as bad as they are. No, so what is the point here? Is the point the hair that's braided, or the gold, or the pearls? No, the point was is that these women were coming in from their prostitution with all that, and those were the allurements of that moment for that, and they're coming into church, and he's saying, you know what, leave all that out there and just come in modestly, and then let's have some self-control. Do you see that? It's not about women in leadership here. It's about women who have come to the Lord but are still acting as they haven't come to the Lord. Just as it's men who came to the Lord and were acting in anger and quarreling and all the other things. And earlier, he talked about men who were homosexual with kids and all the other things. That's an Ephesus thing that was going on. And he's saying, guys, ladies, we've got to get our acts together here, and we've got to show some modesty in our worship and some self-control in our worship. And that's for men and for women. Do you see it there? Because it is proper for women who profess godliness to be clothed with good works. You see, the clothed is they are to be clothed with good works. So the important thing here is about worshiping God, and the result of worshiping God is that our outpouring of good deeds and good works. It's not about whether women should have their hair braided or not, because today that's not the issue. Today's not the issue. I don't know if your hair is braided, your hair is back, your hair is high, your hair is low. I'll give you one. This is an interpretation. So when you go to Israel, how many of you have been to Israel? Okay, we can't go there this year. We were planning to go there this year. We'll hopefully go soon when all this clears up. But for a man, it is a very confusing place, because when you go to a Jewish controlled location as a man, if it's indoors, you have to put a hat on. Yarmulke, anything. It just can be a baseball cap. You got to have something on your head. You go to a Christian site and you can't have anything on your head. I'm going, so one time we were there with some very close friends, very good friends of ours, Elizabeth and mine, and we're there, and we were in some Jewish sites. He's got his baseball cap on, and then we go in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is one of the toughest churches in the world because it's controlled by seven denominations, and a guy comes and hits him like this and hits his head purposely, not just knocking off his hat, but hitting his head so that it really hurt, and saying, get that hat off. And it's like, he forgot. I mean, what's right? Should men have hats on or not have hats on when they worship? Jesus had his head covered when he worshiped, by the way. We do not have our heads covered. It's an interpretation. Back then, women were supposed to. 1 Corinthians 11, verse 4 says, women, cover your heads when you come into the sanctuary. Not one of you has your head covered. And I'm not offended by that, by the way. I'm not offended by that, because that was then and this is now. But modesty, so what is the biblical authority here? The biblical authority here is with modesty and self-control, professing godliness with good works. Do you see the difference? The relative part was, we're not, and I say this with respect, we're not a bunch of prostitutes coming walking in who just got saved. Now, maybe there are some, and we're glad you're here, but most aren't. But there are other things that you have come in, other problems, because it would be real easy for us to go, you prostitutes, dress right, and then I'm the angry, and I'm proud, and I'm this, and I'm quarreling, and I'm got rumors, and I'm doing all these other bad things, and I don't work on my life, I only work on their life. And the Bible is about working on our life. I've got to work on my life. You've got to work on your life. Verse 11, it only gets harder from here. Let a woman learn quietly with all submissiveness. I do not permit a woman to teach or to exercise authority over a man. Rather, she is to remain quiet. For Adam was formed first, then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived and became a transgressor, yet she shall be saved through childbearing. Question is this, is now the time that he's moving into church leadership of women? And I believe the answer is no. He's still in the subject of worship. Now think about it. These women who were coming into the church had no knowledge of the Bible, no knowledge of the Old Testament, no knowledge of the law of Moses, no knowledge of the Gospels, no knowledge of Jesus Christ, no knowledge of love your neighbor as yourself. They just get saved. They come in and they're talking because that's what they do in the Temple of Diana, talk and make noise and make spectacles of themselves. And he is saying, be quiet. Why? Because of what Francois said. Now you're going to get mad at Francois too. Because Francois said, when you're talking, you can't hear God. Remember last week? He said, sometimes in prayer, you just got to be silent. See, the quiet, the word quiet here is the word listen. It's the word listen, which is an active word. Quiet is a passive word. Listening is an active word. You've got to be quiet, women. And it was the specific women of that day, be quiet because you've got to listen to what God has to say. And at that point in time, there were not women who were trained to teach the scriptures, not in Ephesus at least. And so it was the men who taught the scriptures. Now let's digress for a minute. What is the Bible's view of women? Let's do digress out of worship and into women. Well, as I read the Bible, the Bible has a high view of women. I just want you to know, if you're a lady in this room, the Bible has a high view of you. And if you're a man who does not have a high view of women, you are not being biblical at that point in time. Think of Moses. His triplet of accountability was his brother Aaron and his sister Miriam. Miriam was a strong advocate of what occurred. When you move forward into the period of the judges, who was one of the greatest judges? It was Deborah. When the men were, Deborah did it. And you know what Deborah did after she destroyed the enemy and after she brought the children of Israel together? Do you know what she did? Nobody remembers this. She preached a sermon. Oh, no, she didn't. She sang a song, the Bible says. Well, they sang songs back then because they wanted everybody to remember it word for word, and you'll remember a song word for word that you won't remember a sermon word for word. She sang a song in Judges chapters 3 and 4. It's an incredible song of Deborah. It was a sermon. I have preached that sermon on multiple times that she gave. It is an amazing thing of how God, how the people listened, and God blessed them, and all the things. It has 3 points in it, and even a poem in it. It's a perfect sermon. She preached a sermon, Deborah. And then you go on and you go, wow, the period of the judges is about to end and the period of the kings is to begin. And there's this godly woman named Hannah who has this son named Samuel, and her godliness was heard all across the land and helped convert the evil high priest into a godly high priest. It was a woman named Hannah who did that. And then you go on, and there's Abigail and all these other women, and Ruth, and my goodness, Rahab, and all these people. And then you get to the last woman of the Old Testament. And one of the last stories of the Old Testament is the salvation of the dispersed Jews in the Persian Empire. Who was the woman? Louder. Esther. Esther. Hadassah. Esther, one of the greatest stories in the Bible, which is still celebrated every year by Jewish people, is Esther. God used a woman to save everybody. Then you close the Old Testament, open the New Testament. What's the first person you see in the New Testament? A lady named Mary. We as Protestants don't like to talk about Mary because we think the Catholics have over-talked about Mary. But let me tell you that God chose a woman to bring his son into the world. I always wondered, why didn't he come down in a chariot, Christ? Just come down the chariot, and there he is, and let's make this world work. And no, he comes to a woman, and he brings them into a family, Mary and Joseph. It's an incredible view. Then you get further in the New Testament. There's another Mary named Mary Magdalene. She's the only one recorded to have been at the death, the burial, and the resurrection of Christ. The only human that is recorded to have been at all three events. She was there Friday. She was there at the death, the burial, Friday night. And then Sunday morning, she was there as well. There may have been others, but she's the only one recorded. A woman is recorded as seeing all three. Those three things are the most important thing in the entire Bible. The gospel, the death, burial, and resurrection. Witnessed by one person, humanly, all three, and it's a woman. Isn't that amazing? Why wasn't it Peter? Why wasn't it John? Because Peter was denying him at the part of that time. John was a little scared, but he was there. He was a good, he's probably the best. Some of the others had dispersed, but Mary Magdalene was there. Then you get into the book of Acts, and remember Aquila and Priscilla? Okay, the only thing you need to remember about this, Aquila's the husband, Priscilla's the wife. In the Bible, when they name people, they name the most important person first. So it's Aquila, the man, and Priscilla, the wife. Well, that's only once. Every other time they're mentioned, it's always Priscilla and Aquila. Priscilla advanced farther in her work in the kingdom than he did, and so she was named before he was named. The Bible has a high view of women. And then we come to this passage, and it seems like it's regressed. So let's read it. Let a woman learn quietly with all submission. I believe that quietly is that these women that were coming in, they had to quiet down. They had to listen. Let's listen to what God has to say. And they had no clue how to tell what God had to say because they were new to this. I do not permit a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man. Rather, she is to remain quiet. Now, is that biblical authority? Is it biblical interpretation? Is it absolute truth or is it relative truth? And I tell you what, you ask 100 people and you're going to get different answers every time. This is what I think. I think it had to do with the Ephesian church itself on this one, because he's talking about worship, and he's talking specifically that there were no women who could speak because they were not trained to speak. A few years ago, Elizabeth and I were, and our team, some of you were there, were in a Middle Eastern country, and when we go to World Lead and we do these conferences and training our partners all around the world, there's co-ed. It's men, it's women. Elizabeth teaches, other women I teach, John Lucas, et cetera, et cetera. So we're in this Middle Eastern country where it's a very male-dominated culture, and the church is very male-dominated. And so we're sitting there, and we were going to start tomorrow, the next day, and we're having dinner with all these men, and there were women there too, but at our table was Elizabeth, these men, and me, and we're talking, and they go, what are you doing tomorrow? And I said, I'll be teaching on such and such, and Elizabeth will be teaching on soul care. Well, they freaked out. Like, a woman teaching? No, we don't do this. Well, I'd already got it approved by their boss, the head of the denomination, months before, because I knew it'd be a problem. I said, well, so-and-so says it's okay. And so they grumbled and said, okay. So the next day, I taught, and then Elizabeth gets up to teach. And I'm sitting in the back of the room, about 35 people in the room, and it did not go well. One guy walks out, another guy puts his head on it like this, and I thought, I've just blown 10 years of work. And she teaches and talks about the importance of your soul and your relationship to God in a way that you've heard her teach it. And so when it was over, the guy who left the room came right back in when she was done, and he came right for me. I thought, oh my, here it comes. He goes, I just want to apologize. I broke down and cried so much to realize that I don't have a strong personal relationship with the Father. Now, he's the head of a major church in the Middle East. He said, I had to leave. And he said, I wept out in the hallway. I go, wow. Then the guy whose head was down came to me. I thought, now I'm really going to get it. He goes, I'm so sorry. I was so overcome with emotion to realize I don't have a strong personal relationship with the Father. my soul is not cared for, and I just had to lower my head because we're not allowed to cry in public, and I was just bawling the whole time. Then the guy who made the fuss the night before came to me, and I go, this is now I'm going to get it. He runs a seminary in another country nearby. We're in the Middle East here, so this is like tough stuff. He comes to me, and he looks at me, then he looks at Elizabeth, and he goes, Elizabeth, would you come to my seminary and teach this someday? And I go, my goodness. Last night, and then I realized that they don't have a lot of women who are trained to teach, and especially in the care of one soul, and Elizabeth taught, and I thought, and all of them, the walls broke down that moment. It was amazing. We've been back several times since. They're some of our best friends. Elizabeth, I mean, they all come to Elizabeth, not to me. They love her. You hear one male pastor, you've heard 100. You hear a great woman speak. It's fantastic. I do not permit a woman to teach or exercise authority over men. Rather, she is to remain quiet. I think it's listening. I think in this context at Ephesus, now you may say other passages say, and we can argue the role of women in a church, but what I'm arguing is that women, you need to be listening to the Lord. You need to have self-control, modesty, so that you can do good works because you are professing godliness. That's the first half. And the second half is this. And then he goes in, he says, remain quiet, listening. I think, now don't teach. These women shouldn't teach because they're not qualified to teach. You should be listening to the Lord. And then he gets into this whole childbearing thing, and this is where men have abused this for 2,000 years. Keep the woman in the kitchen and have her bearing the children. And that is not what this says. What this says is that the Bible has a high view of family. These women had a view of sexuality was just for personal pleasure, not for family. The family had been long destroyed in the city of Ephesus. There were no families. They were just connecting points, and you'd connect with this guy today and that guy tomorrow. All these connections are going on, and you know what I'm talking about. We got mixed young kids here, so I can't get too detailed, but you know what I'm talking about. And he's saying, no, there is a beauty in a husband and a wife and having a child. And a family, and the entire Bible is filled with family. God chose to enter the world through his son, through a family. He didn't do it with chariots. He did it with a family. He didn't do it with the heavenly host and with the angels and the archangels shouting. They did all that, but he did it into a family. And he's saying, women, family is important. And there is nothing to be embarrassed, ladies, about being a mother or a grandmother. I think it's a high calling. I don't think it's a subjugated thing. I think it's an incredible thing, and I applaud you for what you have done. I applaud these ladies who are up here and all of you, what you have done in childbearing and bringing the next generation into this world and bringing them in so that they can be godly men and women to take the message, the discipleship message, the go into the world message to the next generation. Do you see how that is? See the difference? I could sit here and go, stay in the kitchen and bear children, or I could go, you are the generation that's going to change the world. What did Abraham Lincoln say? The person that rocks the cradle rules the world? That's what he got that from here. So you figure it out. If you want this to be about subjugating women in church leadership, go for it, because that's an interpretation. The way I interpret this is that he wants you women, last part, to continue in faith, to continue in love, to continue in holiness with self-control. Men, don't be angry and quarrelsome. Be people of prayer. Women, show some modesty, self-control, good works. Have faith, love, holiness with self-control. And if you do it, you're going to change the world. Paul said at the end of his life in Acts chapter 20, my favorite people in the world are the people in Ephesus. And if you read in Acts, I think it's 19 and 20, sorry, and you come and you go to it, he makes a special stop to see the people at Ephesus because they practice what Timothy taught them. And this was 20 years later, 15 years later, and they were a godly congregation because the men acted like it and the women acted like it, and I believe we need to act like it. Now, we can argue another day what it should be. Now you're going to say, what is the role of women in this church? I'm just going to tell you real quick, and then we're going to finish. In this church, a woman can do anything but two things. One is they're not elders, and they're not ordained. A woman can teach, a woman can lead, a woman can direct, a woman can do all the things. In this church, our tradition is that they are not elders and they're not ordained. It's just our tradition. I've got good friends where they ordain women and they have elders as women. This church over its history, 70 years, has not done that, but we've had women teach up here on Sundays. We obviously have women leading in Bible studies and programs and all the other things as well. That's what our church does, so I just tell you that as full disclosure. But what is the application here? Let's close. Our time is up. I've taken too long. Our application is this. What is your relationship to God? What is your relationship to God? Man or woman, boy or girl, God is calling us to himself. He's calling us with our hands open, as opposed to clenched or fighting or pointing. He says, open those hands and have them lifted in holy hands to pray and to show some modesty, show some self-control, do some good works, and show people in the community of Ephesus, and this is where I think it applies to us in the community of Boca Raton, what it means to be a woman of God and a man of God. And all I got to say is go out and do it. Let's pray.